Manx Radio's 2016 election coverage.
And now on the programme, as we continue our coverage in the run-up to September's House of Keys general election, we're speaking to another of the candidates to have put the name forward. Today's election 2016 candidate interview is with 36-year-old Carl Parker, who will be standing in the new two-seat constituency of Arbury, Castletown and Mallew. Good afternoon, Carl. Welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Stu.
Spend the first couple of minutes telling people who don't know you who you are and what you stand for and all the rest of it.
Yeah, well, I'm 36 years old. I was born and raised in Port St Mary. I now live in Arbury with my partner and son. My working career started off in accounts. I started off as a junior accounts clerk, lasted about 12 months, realised that accountancy wasn't for me. I moved into a sales executive role. From then I learnt marketing, business planning and so on. Then I became a sales manager. I've worked essentially as a business development manager and a dealer channel sales manager recently for Cable and Wireless. And I set my own production company up in 2010. And to date, we have done 24 productions at the Gaiety Theatre in a little over 5 years. And I also run workshops for children and adults in acting and communication and presentation skills.
So you're a thespian?
Yes.
People would say that we've got enough entertainers in government already.
Well, yes,
you know,
absolutely.
And to have more theatricals might might not be what we need, really. So, yeah. But from what you've said, a lot of the skills that you've got there are things that maybe would be useful to government, marketing, sales.
Well, I think so, because, I mean, I wouldn't say there's anything that directly qualifies me for an MHK, and I don't know whether there is actually anything that qualifies anyone to be an MHK. But I certainly think there are transferable skills there from a business background. But I think probably one of the most important aspects of being a politician is your communication skills and how you interact with people, how you bring people along with you, how you can convince other people of your ideas and so on. But actually, another a skill that I think I've picked up, certainly with the acting side of things, is actually listening, you know, listening to people, listening to their opinions. Because I think it's very easy to sort of, you know, hold fast to your ideas and that's it. Your ideas are the only way, you know.
You're going to deliver a speech rather than a conversation.
Yeah. So it's listening to other people and actually recognising sometimes that you may be wrong and changing your own view as to what you think.
Well, yes, but the other side of that coin is that, you know, if you listen too much to people, then you'll get 1,000 different views on every single thing that you need to make a decision on. So do you not need to start with your own ideas and maybe have them tempered by talking to people?
Well, yeah, that's what I've done initially, because when I announced that I was standing in, I think it was the 20th of July, I launched with a full manifesto published online. The physical manifesto is going out this week, but I did launch with a set of ideals, principles and values and ideas that I think...
Well, you did. I looked at it and it's a fairly weighty volume as well, isn't it? It's like 20 pages or something
it
like
is.
That.
It is indeed. Yeah. I mean, because I did, you know, I've done a research in various... I'm not saying I've got the answers to everything. I'm not going to sit here and, you know, be so arrogant to say that. But, I mean, I do think that there are certain ideas that within the manifesto that I believe will add value to the next administration if elected.
What made you decide to stand for election? Because, I mean, I think that everybody who stands for election, whether or not I like them or think they're any good or not, I admire people for standing because it's, you know, you're sticking your head over the parapet to get shot at. So I think it's a fairly brave decision. What made you decide to do it?
Well, I think, to be honest, the whole point of what I'm saying in the manifesto is I believe that we need a government that is representative of a 21st century modern day society. And at this moment in time, I'm not seeing that. I think that we need more diverse representation in government. If you look at our politicians, 98% of our politicians are middle-aged white men. Not I'm being ageist, but I'm just stating a fact. And I think, is that representative of the diversity that we have on the Isle of Man? And but the answer has to be...
You say you want a 21st century government, but I mean, people shout and scream if we ever suggest, oh, and this is available online, because it's like, well, we've not got a computer, we don't want, we're too old to do that. Yeah. You know, we're a heritage island, that's our big USP, isn't it? We've got an ageing population. How do you square those things then with wanting a 21st century
jurisdiction? Well, that's very true, but you also, I mean, you shouldn't knock out the majority of people who are living through the digital age. You know, we have to recognise the social times in which we live and how we communicate. And I've said in my manifesto, it's not to disregard those who aren't online. I mean, there's still old ways of that you can communicate with those people. There's still direct marketing. There's still direct mail, that kind of contact. But if you look at the statistics, you know, 85% of the voting population actually has a smartphone.
Yeah.
You know, there's something like over 50,000 people on Facebook alone. On the Isle of Man. So I think there is opportunity to explore more engagement with people. Because, I mean, I think if you look at even the youth of today, 16, 18-year-olds who can vote, are they going to interact with politics on a level that may have suited the 1970s?
Well, only if you text them, probably.
Well, absolutely.
Because they never seem to have the faces out of the phones.
That's right.
But that's because I'm an old man, you see, and I get grumpy about things like that.
So I think it's recognising the demographic that we have. It's recognising the modern setting that we live in. It's recognising how we communicate on a social level. And actually opening up wider engagement to the general public, which I think actually would be a good thing. Because, you know, if me personally, and this isn't me standing as a candidate, this is me as a citizen of the Isle of Man, I think how the government communicates with the people of the island is quite appalling, to be honest.
They would say that they're trying to do more and more, though. They've got all sorts of digital strategies in place to try and get people online. You know, you can do your tax returns online. Mm. Government IM website's been improved dramatically over the last couple of years. And even some of our politicians who dare to use Facebook and the forums and things. So, you know, do you not think that they're moving in the right direction?
Well, it's slowly but surely, but I still think they could be more done. You know, and I do think... You know, to raise certain issues in terms of Manx Gas, the MEA, these kind of things that, you know, there have been public outcries about and, you know, things have been swept on the carpet. This is what I'm more referring to, is those elements within government that, you know, people have been treated as though, you know, the second-rate citizens or the stupid or the people of the Isle of Man don't know, really know what's going on. It's that kind of...
Isn't that though because we've got a government? I mean, Western governments are all the same, which is that it's a them and us situation. Mm. That if you're inside the club, you've got access to all the information and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And if you're outside the club, then you can shout as loudly as you like, but you're only going to get a chance to do anything about it every 5 years.
Well, that's true. But I would, if you look at the report just released by the Cabinet Office, which was a survey of over 2,100 people, you know, only 30% of that survey, but let's take it as a given, 30% of people only have confidence in the parliamentary system.
Yeah.
Only 40% in government. Now, is that a positive? Is that a good thing? I would have to say absolutely not. And what are we going to do about it? Because one of the things I put in my manifesto about government reform is that I look at Sweden and Switzerland. I mean, if I talk about Sweden first and foremost, is that, you know, their people have an over 92% confidence rate in their parliamentary system and in their government officials. And so the question is, OK, so here's the Isle of Man. Only 30% of people are confident in the parliamentary system. In Sweden, they're 92%. So what's the difference? What actually is happening in the two different architecture of the politics? What's actually happening? Well, if you look at Sweden, they have accountability and transparency at the very heart of what they do. And, you know, those two words, I think, have been used rather loosely with past elections on the island, because where is the substance?
Yeah.
You know, one can say, well, how can we be more accountable? How can we be more transparent? How can we restore public confidence? And there are certain measures that a government can take to remedy the situation that we find ourselves in terms of public confidence. And I think that's something that we need to do.
What do you think that the average voter really wants? Do you think that they want somebody who's going to consult them on everything that comes up? Or do you think that the electorate wants to vote people in to do that job of politics for us?
Oh, yeah, no, I'm not talking specifically direct democracy. I mean, that's a very strong argument. I don't think personally, even though I've put that we need to move into a digital democratic age, but that's more for engagement. In terms of direct democracy, every single item of government's going out to people to vote on first and foremost. I personally don't believe that the Isle of Man's ready for that kind of thing. I know there will be people listening who will completely disagree, and that's absolutely right. But I think what we do need, and when I've mentioned Switzerland, the whole point of Switzerland is that the Swiss government recognises that the real power lies with the people. It's not with the state or the establishment. And I think that's another aspect that we should look at changing, because I think over the years, you know, we've kind of lost sight of what a democracy really is, you know.
A democracy is where you take a vote on everything. You know, you have a referendum and everybody's going to vote to stop paying income tax. You know, that's the trouble with that, isn't it? Whereas as a politician, your job might be to put income tax up.
Yeah. Well, that's right. But what I was referring to is more to do with, you just said it before, it's a them and us situation, when really I think government is an extension of society, or it should be an extension of society. MHKs are voted in. They are there to represent the people, not themselves. And that is something, you know, that they obviously need to be consciously aware of.
All right.
In terms of a direct democracy, the only thing that element that I think would be good for the Isle of Man is actually if there's a piece of legislation going through into Tynwald and so on, is that if the Manx people rallied around and said, no, we don't want this legislation, and you have, say, 4,000 or 5,000 e-signatures or signatures say, no, we're against this policy, that policy gets taken back into House of Keys, and either they, you know, amend it, bring it back, or they disregard it. So that for me is would be a positive.
That sort of transparency.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're calling for a priority budget. What does that involve? Are we talking about a two-tier level now of services, where you've got priority services and you've got things that are less important?
Well, I think the whole reason why I've mentioned priority budget and working from a priority budget is that, you know, the general public, and I've heard this on the doorstep as I've been going around, a lot of people are quite angry in terms of the waste in government, in terms of money just being spent on things that we don't need, as published in the paper. So,
well, like what? Give me examples.
Well, Slock, for example, did we need 473,000 on Slock? Do we need a diesel locomotive train that doesn't work, you know, for 2 years? The Shawbrows car park, roundabouts. I mean, even, you know, it was questionable. What's that road work? Richmond Hill, sorry.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's questionable. But I think, you know, in terms of the quote that Phil Gorn is supposedly said to the select committee, that, well, we had underspend in this department, so I had to spend the money on something. If that's happening in that department, then you can guarantee that's happening across the whole range of government. And that, for me, is where people are angry, is that, look, how can you say, well we're going to, there isn't enough money for, I'm speaking hypothetical,
yes,
there isn't enough money for nurses, or we can't provide this vital medicine for the 7-year-old with muscular dystrophy. Yet, but we can spend £400,000 on a diesel locomotive train that we don't need, you know. And I think that is where the anger is coming from, that how can we, you know, the government say, right, everyone's got to tighten their belts. And yet, you know, there is just blatant waste within government. So a priority budget is basically having a common sense blueprint and putting services that are a priority at the top of the list.
You're using hypotheticals. Let me make one for you then. So you've been elected in September.
Mm-hmm.
You've risen to a, you know, maybe a ministerial position. Your civil servants come to you and they say, right, Carl, this is what we need to do. We need to buy one of these because it's the answer to all our problems. Mm. And enough of them say, that's exactly what we need. Yes, he's right, that's what we need to do. You'd buy it, surely. I mean, talking about locomotives and things like that. Surely you've got to be led by your civil servants on things like this. You're not going to be an expert on...
Well, unless they can present a strong business case to show that actually that...
But I'm sure that they did. I'm sure the civil servants did make a strong case for it. And I'm not disagreeing with you that, you know, the thing doesn't seem to be, you know, fit for purpose, yeah, or whatever. But, you know, somebody must have made a strong case for it. And your job as a politician, surely, is to listen to your department.
Yeah.
And go along
with
the experts.
Well, yeah, that's right. But that's when you're talking of a departmental budget. I'm talking sort of like an umbrella, if you will, if I can use that analogy, of what are our priorities. So in terms of, say, public services, I mean, one of the dangers, I mean, we'll probably talk about health anyway. One of the dangers with the health budget going over by, say, I think £10 or £12 million last year, or this year, should I say, is that that may be having a knock-on effect on the police force and fire service and so on. And, you know, it's a case of, right, have we got any money to waste? You know, these items that we don't need, money that is being spent that shouldn't be spent. So what I'm basically saying is that, you know, we need to go through the whole government accounts, the whole system, and with a fine-tooth comb and say, these are our priorities. Anything after that is, if we have the money, fine. If we don't, these services have to have.
But on that basis, things like Douglas Promenade might not get done for another 10 years, might they? I think you say that we'd actually rather have more nurses than get the Douglas Promenade scheme underway.
Well, again, if I can put that into context, is that the Douglas Promenade, I do believe that the Douglas Prom needs to be resurfaced. I don't think it needs the full Rolls-Royce scheme, as I mentioned in my interview with John Moss. Now, again, that has to do with priorities. What are our priorities? You know, you could argue that £20 million could be spent purely on specialists or purely on boosting nurses, boosting police, other, you know, sort of policies that can help those in fuel poverty, which I do think that the government, you know, should implement straight away. Because, I mean, you know, if you look at wall insulation, roof insulation, that only costs about £1.4 million to those homes. But, you know, it will have a positive impact because, again, a lot of anger and frustration is coming through. Is this £120 million unauthorised loan to the MEA has bolstered prices. We have an unregulated gas market, even though the OFT are supposedly regulating the market. I mean, I can't imagine Manx Gas getting away with the standard charges that they've done in the UK, if that was properly scrutinised.
But there's competition in the UK, and we're probably never going to have competition in the Isle of Man, are we?
Well,
isn't that what drives prices down?
Well, yes, absolutely. And I do think we should at least invite other gas suppliers to the island. You know, the least we can get is a no from companies. But I think that would help, you know, serve the Isle of Man people better. And something like Ofgem, we need independent regulation of the Manx gas and electricity.
What do you think about the size of the public sector workforce? Do you think it's about right? Do you think it's too big? And if you think it's too big, where would you shave jobs?
Well, I can't answer that directly in terms of, well, I think we only need 8,000 workers or we need 7,500 workers. I think that would have to be done by a professional company who could come in from the outside and go through the whole of the government spectrum and say, right, actually, to have a fully functional government, you only need, say, 7,500 workers. We've got 9,000. OK, so where do we move the 1,500 workers? So it's not as simple as, right, OK, well, we identify we need to move 1,000 workers from the public sector into the private sector, because obviously you need to make the jobs first in the private sector for that to work. But I'm sure there are areas where one could raise an eyebrow to say, well, should they be under, you know, public sector contracts? And it could be the baggage loaders at the airport. I'm not, you know, saying anything negative to them, because my nephew was actually a baggage loader at the airport. So, but what I'm saying in context is that, you know, should they be classed as civil servants? Should they be getting the public sector pensions, or could that be a service that is privatised?
Okay, where do you stand on the tax cap?
Tax cap, I think, if you look at it historically, hasn't really made a tremendous impact in terms of what it was originally for. So I am all for removing the tax cap, because I think it's not serving its purpose. I mean, one could argue that actually if you remove the tax cap and you say to wealthy entrepreneurs, businessmen, OK, well, if you create 250 jobs, OK, then that's when you can start to pay less tax. And, you know, actually, if you create 1,000 jobs, again, hypothetical talk, you can have that tax cap of 125,000. I don't think it should be like a universal, right, that's it, you know, 125,000.
So attach conditions to it, maybe.
I think so. Yeah, I think that's probably the most fair solution to that situation.
We need to save money as an island. We need to make more money as an island. So you want to form an official group of business ambassadors to negotiate on the international stage. Don't our politicians do a reasonably good job of that already?
Well, they may do, but I think to have people like, as I mentioned before, James Mellon working on our behalf in terms of the international stage and the contacts and so on, I think...
Would he do it?
He would. I had a conversation with him down at Ireland Expo, and I said this to him. I said it in the interview with John Moss. I put it to him, do you think that the Isle of Man would benefit from having a group of business ambassadors? He said, absolutely right. Gave me his business card. I sent him an email to say, thank you very much for that quick chat, etc., and I'll be in touch. He sent one back to me saying, look, you know, I wish you all the very best. If you are successful, please come and talk to me, because, right, you know, it's something that he would be very interested in. And I think, you know, it's not the UK government established this in 2008. Gordon Brown introduced this measure, and the UK have about 53, if I'm right, 53 business ambassadors. And, you know, they don't work on, you know, they're not getting paid wages. This is something that they do for the benefit of the people of the Isle of Man, the benefit of the economy.
I think
and
they
so
usually
on.
Get knighthoods out of it and things like that, don't
well,
they?
Well, I'll just raise an eyebrow for that one.
All right.
But in essence, I mean, what they are paid is flights and expenses. That's it. So it's not as if they you know, James Mellon come on board and he's getting paid £200,000. No, it's not that at all. It's okay, James, can you go out and represent us in India, China, America, wherever? Can you you know, take negotiations in this business deal, that business deal? So I think to have people of that calibre representing the Isle of Man on the international stage to drive business to the island, to drive investment to the island, can only be a positive step for us.
All right. Well, given your impresario background, unsurprisingly, you'd like to see the development of the television and film industry in the island.
Yeah.
Haven't we had a go at that, and it's all kind of fallen apart?
One could say, but I have to say that I think it's lacked vision. I think a lot of things, there were mistakes made.
Wasn't the only reason that people came here to make films the fact that there was a VAT implication?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And we have to remedy that fact, and we have to be competitive again, certainly with the UK market. But let me just go into depth about the television and film industry, because I've heard people say that we need to boost tourism, and there's been very little substance from what I hear as to how we can boost tourism. Now, if you look at Midsummer Murders, if you look at Doc Martin filmed in Cornwall, you know, those long-running television series are creating around £30 to £40 million to the local economy where they are filmed. And now, if you take Game of Thrones, which was filmed, or part of it was filmed in Northern Ireland, that is now bringing £100 million
by what,
a year
tourists
to the local
then wanting
economy
to visit the scenes,
yeah,
where these things are shot.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you go online, visit Northern Ireland, they have a section on Game of Thrones, and they have a whole raft of things that visitors and tourists can do. And you can go to that location, this location, and you know, there's the whole range. But the key factor is, in terms of boosting tourism, actually creating jobs and reviving an industry, is a television series that can be filmed solely on the island. And not just one television series. I would argue that you could actually look at the American market, the Canadian market, because they go absolutely mad over period dramas that were made in the UK.
I think that sounds fantastic. But would you ever get big film and TV production crews over here on the basis that there are very few places to put them up? You know, if you've got Madonna or Guy Ritchie coming over to make a film, and they've both been here already,
yeah,
you know, where are you going to put them? We've not got the 5-star hotel, surely, that these top crews would expect.
Well, you've just answered the question, because they've already been here, and they've already, you know, we've made big films on the island. But in terms of what I was saying about a television series, that is a surefire way to boost tourism. If it's a long-running TV series, so one of the things that
I think one of your ideas is to get a BAFTA-winning screenwriter,
absolutely,
to actually do it. And
absolutely.
So Isle of Man government would give them £500,000,
yeah,
quid or whatever it might be.
Well,
and
no,
say,
you'd only be looking about to commission a writer.
Yeah.
And I'm talking a top quality writer. You'd only be looking about, say, £50,000, £75,000,
right,
maximum. But, you know, if you look at Bergerac, I mean, Bergerac in Jersey, I mean, it's that kind of thing that we need for the island, and that will revive the television industry on the island. It will create jobs. The amount of people who leave to go to the UK, in terms of, you know, media students, who there's no work here for them. You know, we can bring, you know, hopefully a lot of Manx people back to work in the industry. And as I say, it doesn't have to just be one. I'm talking, say, two or three long-running television series that will bring in, you know, substantial amounts of money in terms of local economy and actually boost tourism. What that theme, what the genre would be, is open to debate and open to discussion, but that would have to be
really,
with the writers. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Very quickly, you'd like to see the corporatisation of the steam packet. I mean, you're not going to have a chance to do that probably in the next administration, are you? So is that just pie in the sky?
Well, it could be pie in the sky, but I think it's a well worthwhile pie in the sky to have, because The fact of why I'm saying that we should corporatise the steam packet, I mean, actually, you would have to go through the process of nationalisation to then corporatise it. But the whole, again, in terms of boosting tourism, if you look at the cost for people to travel from, say, if you go to Manchester to Barcelona, Manchester to the Isle of Man, well, you're going to choose Barcelona or Rome, aren't you? So, I mean, you know, we have to be realistic. We're not going to have the 1950s, 1960s tourism that we used to have. But let's at least try to boost tourism in a way that we can, A, be proud of, and B, actually regulate the prices on the steam packet.
Rather than looking for expressions of interest from other providers, you think the government should buy the steam packet effectively at the best price can get?
No, what I've said is if a corporatisation didn't receive enough public support, what I've said is that we should open up the tender process to make sure that we negotiate the best possible deal for the Isle of Man.
All right, we're out of time, but Carl Parker, tell the people of Arbury Castle Town and Maloo why they should vote for you in September.
I think what has been lacking in Tynwald is integrity, is honesty, is openness, and that is something that I will stand by and stick to. And I promise you now that the manifesto that has been printed, that will be handed to the Chief Minister, and I'll be saying, look, these are the things that I've been elected on. This is what I'm going to stand on. Everything else can be up for negotiation, but I want to guarantee and promise you that you can form a rational decision based on a manifesto that I've published, because I will stand by it 100%.
All right, candidate for Arbury Castle Town and Maloo, Carl Parker, thanks for joining us today.
Keep up to date with the latest House of Keys General Election 2016 coverage on manxradio.com.